Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Today, we're joined by Ambassador Sheila Sisulu. She is the Chancellor of Walter Sisulu University in the Eastern Cape, South Africa. She holds a number of board positions, including the Tiger Brands Foundation, the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, Historic Schools Trust, Imlambo Foundation, and Shared Interest. She served as a special advisor in the South African Department of Agriculture. Between January 2008 to January 2013, she was the Deputy Executive Director for Hunger Solutions in the Office of the Executive Director of the World Food Programme in Rome, Italy. In her first appointment to the World Food Programme, she served as a Deputy Executive Director for Policy and External Affairs. And prior to joining the World Food Programme, she was South Africa's Ambassador to the United States from 1999. Her diplomatic career began in 1997 as Consul General for South Africa in New York. In addition to her diplomatic skills, Ambassador Sisulu has over 25 years of experience in South African politics and government. Prior to her tenure abroad, she served as a special advisor to the Minister of Education and a member of the team assigned to the task of drawing up new legislation. She was responsible in particular for policy on gender equity, youth development, and early childhood care and education. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Clearly, in terms of your experience, education has been a critical path in your lifetime. It's a vital tool to empower individuals and societies, and your passion for education has been demonstrated throughout your career. You received your BA degree from University of Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland, and hold a postgraduate degree in education from the University of Witwatersrand. You obtained your honorary doctorates from University of Maryland and City University of New York. And today, you hold the position of Chancellor of the Walter Sisulu University in Eastern Cape. Now, even basic levels of numeracy and literacy have shown profound benefits on the well-being of women and their children, whether it is greater control over fertility rates, reduced child mortality, improved health management, and poverty reduction. And according to UNESCO, an additional year of schooling yields a 12% increase in earnings. In your opinion, are we as a country doing enough to ensure that this knowledge and education is preached in every possible form and passed on from our mothers to their daughters, especially in underprivileged communities?
Yeah, I think specifically South Africa is doing quite a lot in educating young women. First of all, the Constitution demands that there be no discrimination. And I think on the continent, in general, there is a recognition that this is important and an effort to open up opportunities for children by governments in, for example, providing free education and free access to education. The challenge, and if here in South Africa and elsewhere, is in attitudes.
Attitudes from staff or attitudes from parents?
Attitudes from society. Let me put it that way. I think attitudes from society still put women in particular categories. A certain education is enough. Those that venture outside of quote-unquote, the norm, either to be nurses, maybe doctors, teachers, maybe professors, to wish to become astronauts, are few and far between. And therefore, children in school, what they see in primary school, particularly, the teachers are mainly women. And the principal is usually a man.
And in the teaching profession, when I had a conversation with the Dean of Education at University of Pretoria, she indicated approximately 70% of teachers are women. Mm-hmm. So it's a highly feminized sector.
So the girl child, when they see positions in education from a very early age, nursery school, they're only women. Primary school, mainly women. And high school, some women. So as the authority position grows, women become fewer. As I say, the principal in primary school will be most likely a man, but the deputy could be a woman. It's so where does this come from? It's socialization. That the ambition, therefore, of girls is honed at a very early age, that they will tend to be secondary to their male counterparts. And then you go to university, at university, it becomes a big story in South Africa, and I think elsewhere on the continent, when a woman becomes principal of a university.
Yes, and I think at the moment we've only got two in place in South Africa as being principals are mm-hmm. female.
And none come to mind women in other universities on the continent.
But yet, in terms of the education differentials at a university level, so tertiary, we're seeing a disparity between women. Actually, there's 70% more mm-hmm. women studying at university level and 40% men. So hopefully in time, this is something that's going to shift the demographic further up the hierarchy structures.
Yes, it will. It will shift it, I think, for as long as we don't tend to be thankful for small mercies. And that's one of the problems I have about how we speak about women's achievements. Oh, no, we've done very well compared to whenever, it's improving. Now, we've come from an apartheid system. There's been slavery in the world. It ended, apartheid ended. Okay, there's still a lot that needs to be done. But people are not thankful for little mercies that come from being a democratic country. People are not thankful for little mercies that come from slavery ending. Oppression must stop. And, the attitudes about, don't worry, it's getting better. It can be.
Otherwise, it just becomes too labored.
Exactly.
And it's a point of saying enough is enough.
Enough is
enough. We have a constitutional right.
Absolutely. It's a constitutional right. And it can be in dribs and drabs.
And staying with the education theme, mm-hmm. when we were talking offline, you mentioned that you had earned your teaching qualification in Lesotho. Mm-hmm. And because at the time when you were going into the teaching mm-hmm. profession, you were prohibited from teaching because your qualification came from outside mm-hmm. of the country. And in 1978, this is where you taught the class of 1976 mm-hmm. in South Africa. Mm-hmm. You joined the South African Committee on Higher Education, and you held various directorship mm-hmm. positions. One of them was with Turret College. Mm-hmm. You developed a program which was designed to provide young men and women who were persecuted by the regime with opportunities to receive alternative, progressive, and quality education, with qualifications that would prepare and enable them to further their studies, both in exile as well as South Africa, mm-hmm. because you mentioned there was a loophole in the correspondence aspect. And many of those graduates from Turret have now become agents of change. They were involved in the anti-apartheid movement, and they've risen to influential positions in post-apartheid South Africa. And I think that this really emphasizes education as a means to change not only of how the recipients of education have developed, mm-hmm. but also how they in turn can transform and change other people's attitudes mm-hmm. and mindsets. And for you, this must have been an incredible experience and at the same time a huge responsibility for the future of South Africa.
I have done many things in my life that I have enjoyed and been proud of. And I must say, having had that opportunity. At the time, one didn't recognize it. It was almost like it's got to be done, because there was a fallacy in the country about black children not wanting education. And being able to teach these young people who were supposed to be the ones who didn't want education, and found the most dedicated, very serious, ambitious, in the broadest terms of the word, educationally, these young people, was like, yeah, now this is what it's about. I didn't have to explain it too much, that it's not that they didn't want an education. They wanted good education. What they were getting in the classroom, they were rebelling against what was being taught to them, where they were almost forced to internalize inferiority, because the syllabus and the curriculum presented them as the inferior ones, and that the rulers, the minority rulers of the time, the government of the time, apartheid government, was actually doing them a favor to give them an education, and that these were often in the exam papers. So you pass by accepting your inferiority, because you have to do rote learning of these quote-unquote facts based on colonialization, the apartheid regime, and if you got it wrong, you failed. And to get it right meant you have to accept it. So
that must have had tremendous conflict with people in terms of having to accept these issues.
Of course, of course. I mean, if you, the right answer to a question in history, say, is that you as a black person were a problem for the white colonizer, and that's the correct answer. You were a burden of the white man, and that's the correct answer.
Ambassador, I'm at a loss for words at the absurdity of how things were.
Absolutely. And these, as I say, these young people wanted an education. And through Tarit, in retrospect and at the time, I really feel honored that I was part of a team that enabled them to get an education that opened horizons for them. Those who remained in the country, and even those who went into exile. Engineers came out of that class, what I call the class of 76. And yeah, it's one of those things that I really feel thankful that I was part of.
Well, it, I'm sure, will contribute to your legacy. Whilst we're talking about change and development, women's leadership, mm-hmm. I think it's a very important issue in terms of building capacity for women, both for women in South Africa as well as women across the rest of the continent. And for somebody who constantly works to succeed, or should I say almost twice as hard as men to succeed, how do you see female leadership in the country?
It's like we have to breathe, right? So without women in leadership, we are breathing very shallowly as a country, because we are using half our lungs.
Oh, you're absolutely right, yep. There.
I think your overall question is about leadership.
Yes,
it's again the point I made earlier about what young people see, and it's young men and young women, the boy child and the girl child. If what they see is that men lead, then their vision for themselves is limited. So we need to begin in education. We need to present in the education sphere, not necessarily an equal number of men and women, at any rate, because there are more women than men, statistically.
Yes, we're 52%.
Yes. But that in the areas that influence our lives, and I might be a little controversial here and venture into religion, which I would rather normally not, but even religious institutions, the leaders, whether they are the imam or the priest or in the synagogue, the rabbi, are men.
Yes, they are.
And the congregations are women. The worker bees are women. The hierarchy. So what children see all around them, unfortunately, reinforces that men lead and women do. So I think education in its broadest terms, at school, in other institutions of society, needs to take that into account. And then as we move on to structured areas of society like politics, like business, there needs to be a consciousness to promote women's leadership because they can, not because they are women. Mm-hmm. And they can. So, but there needs to be a greater push because women have been disadvantaged. So there needs to be a greater consciousness to identify those women, nurture them, and let them lead.
And would you say that these types of aspects are where elements like the gender equality mm-hmm. and empowerment bill comes into play? Because mm-hmm. of a population group which has been traditionally disadvantaged, mm-hmm. in order to gain and to come up to a certain level, to catch up, as it mm-hmm. were, mm-hmm. there needs to be some form of legislation to empower.
Totally. There has to be. I think we do have legislation, and I agree that we should have legislation, but it's compliance.
Yes.
That is, you know, and are we holding people in authority to account so that they respect and are compliant with the legislation that protects, that ensures that women catch up, because women are playing catch up, you know. I was saying to you, partly, well, in large measure, because the work that women do has actually never been recognized. And nobody talks about the bearers, the carers, the cooks.
The ones who are providing the sustenance and the stability.
That ensures the species
yes.
continues. The human species relies a great deal on the role of women. But that role is unrecognized, unpaid, and if they have to get out of that, they have to do that role and the role that they have to, where they earn a living. So 50% of their work actually is free.
It's a very interesting mm-hmm. point there that you raise. And
free in quotes.
Yes, free in quotes. Yeah. And on that note, I mean, one of the things that I look at when we look at the working world, mm-hmm. I see that it was almost designed around what I call men's hours, mm-hmm. where in effect, when we look at the work that women have to perform in the household, that we're sort of losing half of our best multitaskers mm-hmm. because they are having to still comply with the traditional expectations.
Right.
They're then having to put in their efforts into trying to develop a career and working around their family and mm-hmm. juggling things. What is your perspective of this? And do you think that now in the 21st century, we'll be able to come up with something which can restructure things in order to accommodate women's multiple roles?
You know, when you introduced me, you spoke to the fact that I have been and continue to be an advocate for childcare. It's part of the infrastructure that should be put in place to the same degree as the infrastructure for education, for a number of reasons. One of them being that children who are born of women who cannot afford childcare actually are disadvantaged from the get-go. First of all, because their mothers stay home and maybe get a grant in the case of South Africa. And if they have to go and work, if they can find work out of the house, paying work, they have to pay somebody else to look after their child. And usually it's minimum care, just care, so that they are safe and maybe they have a meal during the day. Those children 5 years forward come in with children who have had 5 years either of early childhood care, preschool, who are 5 years ahead in preparatory terms.
When you look at the development of children, it is so rapid in that,
yes,
that time frame.
Exactly. That's the most, that is the where the most must be put in. And so, and there have been studies all over the world that showed that children who went to preschool, got preschool education from an early age, stay longer in school. The others just don't cope. They struggle. And they could be brilliant, but they catch up.
Get their lost out on the foundation.
Absolutely. So when, therefore, children, say, of single parents, of poor parents, get caught in the cycle of not making it to their full potential. So the infrastructure to enable women to contribute to the economy begins with preschool. Since my time, it has improved, I think, by about 50%. But it's from a very low 6%. Only 6% of children who should have been not in preschool, but in early education, were in early education in South Africa at the time. Fast forward 21 years, 10% maybe?
Still very low.
Still very low. It feels like 50%, but it's still very low. And the majority of children in rural areas don't even have a look into even care. Their mothers have to put them on their backs to go to the field and put them down to work in the field. If government were to skew the budget for education, I would argue that the infrastructure for early childhood education and care should actually surpass the what government is putting in at the top end of education. That way, young girls will stay longer in school, their families will be healthier, and their children will be more educated.
Well, it has a whole set of positive
effects. Absolutely,
knock-on
effects. It's a win-win-win.
Ambassador, thank you very much for raising that perspective. It's one that I haven't come across before, and I think it is highly, highly valuable. We'll take a short break.
Hi, I'm Zonke Dikana, a South African Afro-soul musician, songwriter, and producer. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band. Today we're talking to Ambassador Sheila Sisulu, who is the current Chancellor of the Walter Sisulu University in the Eastern Cape. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In our previous discussion, Ambassador Sisulu emphasized the importance of education and the infrastructure investments that apply to it. Now, Ambassador, taking a slightly different turn in the conversation, after the last economic collapse on Wall Street in 2008, there was a very interesting piece of research that came out and compared key position behavior based on gender, like market traders, CEOs, and policymakers in the year which led to the market downfall in the USA. And these results were quite conclusive. It showed that men, in comparison to women counterparts, took significantly more risks, which directly led to these unavoidable results. And following this study, there was other research commissioned which took place on gender behavior, with a conclusive answer stating that women in leadership positions show more compassion to find peaceful solutions based on compromise in comparison to men who hold the same types of positions. What's your point of view on this?
I think earlier I talked about carers. Not all that we're socialized to do as women is bad. And I think one of the elements of our socialization is the family, holding the family together. And part of it, I mean, there's been some research that, people talk about the nesting instinct when a woman is pregnant and they're about to have their baby to protect. And so all of those, point us in the direction of peaceful resolutions to conflict because we want to protect our offspring. Doesn't mean that we lie down and be doormats. In fact, the contrary. We will fight to protect our offspring. But it is how we fight.
And one of the things in the conversations that I've had with other lady leaders is that women tend to take a more consultative approach to have inclusive conversations of all stakeholders before making an important decision.
It's easier. It's easier to, if you want, manage children and their fathers by consensus rather than by conflict. Doesn't always work easily, but indeed, as I said, it's to do with the way we ourselves are nurtured by our mothers, how women, how girls are included in even housework. And just as an example, a young man was telling me that how he longed to have a sister because then he wouldn't have to cook. And when I engaged him, he said, no, I wanted to go and play soccer. And when my sister was born, we were very happy because she could then take over the cooking. I said, but there were four of you boys, you had cooking and nothing had happened to you. Why should it be that the girl can't go and play? She's like, soccer is not playing.
Okay, so soccer was his work.
Yes, soccer was in his view. Yes, in his mind, even as a young boy. But he's older now and recognizes that, in fact, he was missing out time to be with his mom, time to be in the home. And I think that closeness, much as it disadvantages girls in the future and sort of paid for, enables them to work with others. Whereas what boys choose to do, go and play soccer, it's combative. Even if it's teamwork, it's combative. The games and the things that girls do tend not to be combative. Not that it's not competitive, but it's not combative. So,
That's an interesting view, mm-hmm. because often we always associate competitiveness mm-hmm. with combativeness.
No, it is not the same thing. Of course, it's not the same thing. To be competitive is to do the best that you can. It is not to hit out at your opponent. That's a big difference. When you're competitive, you are competing. You want to be the best, but not at all costs. Combativeness implies that you are in battle with an opponent.
It does. And I think that that's a wonderful viewpoint in terms of the nurturing effect mm-hmm. that you've raised on the benefits of families being held together mm-hmm. with the glue of women in the household. Earlier we were speaking about education. We were also talking about the fact that there are more women mm-hmm. in terms of the population divide. And I'd mentioned that at tertiary institutions in South Africa in particular, the majority of university graduates are women. But we're still experiencing issues of oppression, issues of inequality. And I often wonder if women could just use their electoral power more, and if they could participate in every possible forum, exercising their democratic rights, whether it is in school committees or town councils or political parties, because given their majority, if they can unite together, they've got an opportunity to create change, to change how our country looks. What is your intake and opinion on that?
I couldn't agree more. I would even go further. I mean, women's power of numbers, I think, is surpassed by women's power of the economy, over the economy. What they buy, where they buy. If women were to unite economically and use their purchasing power, I mean, who are the big shoppers?
Yes, even if they're not earning the money.
No, absolutely.
I think it's 70% is mm-hmm. held by women's purchase.
Yes, exactly. So if women were to just one day say, today we're only buying from women's businesses, can you imagine what that would mean? How many companies, how many even small businesses would survive that one day of collective action to support women's businesses? You know, in a street market, to say, no, I'll buy my tomatoes today from this woman because it's a woman's business. There may be a man behind it, whatever, but the visible face. I don't think as women we use our numbers. Through voting, we use our numbers with control of resources. But when women work, how they control those resources is critical. So if the 52% were consciously spending it to promote women in all spheres of life, whether by voting for parties that clearly not only have policies that promote women, but actually promote women's leadership. We would have a different political sphere.
And also the importance, as you said, it's no good just having the legislation in place. We need that compliance to take effect.
Absolutely. So we are not using our power as much as we could.
Goes back to what you said about attitude change and building on those mindsets.
Yeah.
Now, Master Sisulu, one of the questions that I ask all my guests on this program who have made tremendous achievements in their respective fields is what they consider to be the factors that have contributed to their success. Some people talk about the influence of their mothers. Others talk about hard work and perseverance. So I'd like it if you can tell us some of the key factors that you consider to have been drivers in your success.
I know that one of them is, of course, how I was raised by my parents. My mother had a view about work. She would not have been able to theorize about it. But in the way she expected us to carry out our duties at home, both my brother and I and the young ones who came after us, but because my brother and I were close in age, we were expected to do our chores, as my mom would say, so you can stand back and be proud. Didn't matter what chore it was. In particular, it was how you cleaned the floor. It had to be so clean that you can stand back and look at it and almost look at yourself in it. So as a young child, I didn't understand her phrase, don't clean my house as if you're doing me a favor. It was like, it is your house. And I'm doing
you a favor.
But I realized as I grew up that what she was saying was, you have to be proud of everything you do. And later she would say, you have to be proud of the product of your hands, because she was a seamstress. So for her, the line has to be just so. Everything had to be just so. You how you hang your washing. And it was both my brother and I. My dad, it was about also shining our shoes, having things in the right place. We had a tin that had the brush, the polish, and it stayed in the same place. And how you presented yourself publicly was as important as where you woke up. So for my dad, it was you can't get up from a dirty setting and wear smart clothes when you can't show people where you live. It doesn't matter whether it's a shack. It doesn't matter whether it's a back room. It doesn't matter that you actually sleep under a table, which was not unusual at the time because it was just one room with everybody living in it. But it must be clean. You must feel clean 24/7. And so those values of be proud of what you do, it doesn't matter what it is. If it is the product of your work, do it with your all. So you are happy with it, not because somebody's coming to come and check you. So that helped me with my schooling. My dad didn't, it just never crossed his mind that you didn't come top of your class. Just like, why? Is the magic in the one who got top of the class? In some instances, you would feel like you can never please him, but that you did everything possible to remain on top.
So he was striving for excellence.
It was excellence all the time. With my mom, it was that gentle way of be proud of what you produce. With my dad was be the best. So, but as a child, you don't hear these things. They can be actually very oppressive. But I realized much later in life that I was carrying them with me, that I tried at all times to make sure that I loved what I did and did it as best as I could. But I think what was even more important was to recognize what others were doing that I couldn't do and value their work and value their contribution to my being able to achieve what I achieved. As I say, my mom would never have been able to figure out that, you know, the theory of that. As I grew up, I realized that what she was also teaching me was that the cleaner, the housekeeper, the person who does the laundry, who cleans your room at university or whatever, enables you, is your enabler. Respect their work. So don't go trashing where they have cleaned. Don't be careless with your clothes and just because somebody is cleaning up after you.
And it's almost a hidden support structure that people sometimes, I think quite often actually,
always,
take for granted.
Yes, absolutely. And so it's my achievement. But if you look at it, it's never my achievement. I was enabled to achieve what I've achieved by the lowliest person in what I would call my team, from my mother, when she was the one who was doing my laundry, who was making sure that there's a meal on the table, who was making sure that I have a bed to sleep on, my parents. It sounds lame, I think. It will sound lame for some people.
I think it's an important point of reflection to appreciate.
Absolutely, because that's how I feel. Therefore, it also has informed my appreciation of all the people that have made it possible for me, who have enabled me to achieve, and want to also see myself as an enabler of others in whatever small way. It's not always about giving them money. It's being there that people can feel they can come and say, I'm struggling with this. How do I get to achieve? So to a short answer to your question, if I can, about it's my parents, obviously, my brother, partly because we are competitive, not combative. He was more in the sciences, I was more in the humanities. But there was always that, well, I can do better and I can do better.
But in a way, it pushed each other.
Yes, absolutely.
In a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. And but it is also, I think, primarily, I would say, work ethic. Work ethic that says, be proud of what it is that you produce. The product, my mom would say, the product of your hands. And it's a big spectrum of, a wide spectrum of things. From how you clean your house, if that's your responsibility, to how you help your children with homework, to how you write your assignment, to how you study, to how you work with others in subjects that you are not strong in, that you are able to call on assistance from others. So your product, in the end, is as perfect as it can be.
Well, thank you for sharing your factors of success. And it was particularly refreshing to get a view in terms of the enablement and the hidden work that goes on behind the scenes that enables individuals to achieve what it is that they need to do. Ambassador, we're now coming to the end of our show. It's been such a pleasure having you here. So in closing the discussion, during your career, no matter what position you have been heading, you have done tremendous work concerning women's development. So could you please use this platform to send a message of hope to all those women on the continent that due to circumstances, gender equality might not be first on their agenda, but rather the daily struggles of taking care of their family, raising their children, making sure that there's food on the table is probably a more pressurizing reality.
Absolutely and totally. I would like, there are many, I dare say millions of women on the continent who do not wake up in the morning and say, I want gender equality. They want food on the table for their children. They want shelter for their children. the desire in education for their children, clothing on their backs. And to those women, it is important, for those women, it's important that we actually enable them to achieve what those of us who have the privilege, if you want, to engage on discussions on gender and gender inequality and the unfairness of society when it comes to women, that we, as we strive for gender equality, we begin with the upliftment of those women. We begin with ensuring that they, their children, their families are accessing the basic human fulfilling their basic human needs of food, shelter, clothing. I'm not saying that fighting for gender equality is secondary, but without those basics, it is but a dream. And it begins with ourselves in relation to the demands the requirements, rather, that those women have. Because as we started, we said once they have an education, their children will stay longer in school. Their children will be healthier because they know better. So education, healthcare, housing, those basic needs need to be addressed. Not first, they need to be addressed concurrently with ensuring that we all breathe with two lungs.
Thank you very much for your words of inspiration and the emphasis on education as the key enabler. Thank you very much for joining us, Ambassador.
It's been a great honor and very exciting and also stimulating for me.
We look forward to hearing from you again in terms of future developments that take place in your life.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Ambassador Sheila Sisulu, the current Chancellor of the Walter Sisulu University in the Eastern Cape.